a mentor told me early in my career, and this is a mentor who is still in my life today. She told me that as a leader, I should be spending 20% of my time building the bench, making the team stronger, making those that are coming up in their careers more aware, more communicative, and help them develop their leader characteristics and their leadership styles.
Hello and welcome back to Leader Up, a podcast of Army Management Staff College. Leader Up is a professional conversation where we discuss a broad range of leadership and leader development topics with an emphasis on the Army civilian professional. I'm your host, David Howie. On today's episode of Leader Up, Leader Up audience, we've got a very distinguished guest. I'm proud to introduce to you the Honorable Christopher Lohman. And Mr. Lohman is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Sustainment. And in that capacity, he oversees the Defense Logistics Agency and the Defense Microelectronics Activity. And he considers himself to be the senior logistician in the Department of Defense. So, Mr. Lohman, I want to thank you for joining us today on Leader Up.
David, thanks so much for taking the time and having me on the program today. I'm really looking forward to having a discussion about leadership traits and the importance of Army civilians.
And so let's start a little bit about with your background. You're a member of the senior executive service, but you weren't always that. Tell our audience a little bit about how your career developed and the kind of things that you've done in your past that kind of set you up for where you are now.
Thanks, David. So it's interesting. I started my career off as a private E1 in the United States Marine Corps. Spent 4.5 years with the Marines and then decided I wanted to start all over again. And so I joined the Army as a GS5 Army intern, maintenance intern at Red River Army Depot in Texarkana, Texas. I figured over the last 35 years as an Army civilian, I've hit just about every echelon of working relationship, team relationships, and leadership roles that you can imagine. And so I've done a couple of tours overseas. About mid-career-wise, I PCS'd my family and I to Europe to be the chief of supply and maintenance for the United States Army in Europe. I then deployed to Afghanistan some years later in an executive role to lead what was then called Essential Function 5, which was the capacity building responsibility for medical logistics, the traditional maintenance, transportation, and supply roles for the Ministry of Defense and the Ministry of Justice. Also, the building out the network capabilities for the Ministry of Defense and the Ministry of Interior. Following that, came over to back to the headquarters department of the Army, took on a role as the Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations and Strategic Planning, the G357. Really my first role outside of the logistics community. And then from that role, was asked to serve as the acting Undersecretary of the Army, and then assumed, once confirmed by the Senate, assumed the responsibility as the Assistant Secretary of Defense. So what I'll tell you is kind of common theme through all of those roles was really a willingness to cross organizational boundaries, to assume roles where I wasn't necessarily the technical expert going into those roles. And so assuming uncomfortable career broadening type assignments. And finally, really understanding and developing from very early on an understanding of the role of an Army civilian, the relationship with our uniformed service members, and the leadership necessary to push initiatives that are critical to the execution of the Army's mission, and being willing to stand out in front and lead from the front, whether you're leading a team of technical experts, or you're leading a team of policy experts, or frankly, whether you're communicating the Army's mission external to the Army, whether it's to the Hill, on Congress, to Congress members or professional staff members, to the press, or to your neighbors at home. I mean, what it takes is a willingness to communicate the Army's mission, to take on responsibilities and follow through, and finally, to uphold the standards of the Army in whatever role you happen to have.
Tell our audience a little bit about the Defense Logistics Agency, what the role is, what the mission is. What kind of makes that a challenging job on a day-to-day basis?
So the Defense Logistics Agency, its mission is exactly consistent with its name. It is the joint service provider for all of the service logistics needs. It provides all classes of supply, to include bulk petroleum, to include spare parts, construction material, medical supplies, food. It doesn't supply Class 6, which is alcohol. I've often wondered why they don't give me that responsibility, but they don't. And so it supplies everything else. And the Defense Logistics Agency is a global provider of services, like I mentioned, to all of the Joint Service, not just the United States Army. And so as such, it has a very critical role in how the Department of Defense sustains the U.S. Joint Force, wherever it happens to be operating on the globe.
Something that I've been hearing a lot about, and that's data, the importance of data, the relevance of it, what we should be doing at the business end of the Army operation to be focused more on data to help accomplish that goal.
David, thanks so much for that question. So I cannot understate the importance of the role of data and the role of data analytics. Regardless of where you happen to be working in the Army today, data is influencing your responsibilities and the way you're making decisions and executing your role. And so the Army has done a fair amount of investment over the last 15 or 20 years now in sensoring, for example, platforms. Very similar to your car at home, where you have oil sensors and temperature sensors, and you have an odometer that tells you how many miles. In the newer vehicles, you have entire suites of sensors that report on the age of your oil or the age of your brakes or when your tire pressure is low and needs more air. Military equipment is very similar. The Army spent quite a bit of resources, as I mentioned, sensoring platforms. What we haven't really done a good job in, and we're really advancing our investments, are in the areas of data analytics and understanding at echelon what data will inform that particular organization's needs, what decisions they have to make, and where they need business intelligence tools to enhance their decision-making capability. Given that investment in the future, we are really spending a lot of time now in getting into predictive type logistics decision-making, being able to predict, for example, in advance of an operation, how much ammunition is expected to be consumed, putting in motion the resupply of that Class 5 ammunition in advance of the operation. And so there's very little lag time, understanding where probabilities of failure will occur in the future, and depending on those probabilities of failure, pre-position spare parts, or to negate unscheduled maintenance activities. On a flight line, for example, when the Apache won't start up because it's had a failure and you are expecting that Apache to be available for your mission requirements that day, what we're really pushing in terms of data analytics is this predictive business. And so unscheduled maintenance is the biggest readiness degrader that, regardless of capability, the largest readiness degrader the services have. And where we can assess the probabilities of failure and move maintenance actions into scheduled maintenance events, minimizing the unscheduled event, really is a method for us to enhance our readiness regeneration capabilities. And so data is incredibly important, not just to the logisticians, but to the planners, to the operators, to the soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen that are part of our joint force. And so what I would encourage civilians to do is, where you are not as comfortable as perhaps you'd like to be in your data analytics skills, the Army offers quite a bit in terms of data analysis courses, certainly on the civilian sector at your local community colleges and your local universities, there are also a wide array of tools that will enhance your capabilities. Get as smart as you can, as quick as you can, because the use of data and the use of data analytics is not going to go away. It's just going to continue to become an ever larger portion of each of our jobs. I use it every day. Like many of you, I'm not as comfortable as I'd like to be in the world of data analytics. And so I'm getting smarter.
We actually offer a 2-day seminar from our department, Data Foundations, where we talk. We try to encourage Army civilians to be wise about data. And one of the slides that we have says, data is the new bacon. Everybody likes it. It tastes great. It feels good when you get it, but sometimes too much of it can be a little bit of a problem. I wanted to ask, when you talk about predictive analytics, we used to have a program when I was an armor officer, and we had something called the Army Oil Analysis Program, and we didn't understand it. They'd say, take a sample from this tank this week, and it seemed very random. And then a month later, they'd come back and say, that tank needs to go in and have the engine replaced. And we would say, that doesn't make any sense because there's nothing wrong with it. And the response was, the data tells us we can look in there and see, like you're saying, stop it before it's a catastrophic problem, and we can react to a problem earlier.
That's exactly what I'm saying. So AOAP was really the Army's early adoption of data analytics. Of course, it required physical samples. Those physical samples to be mailed to a lab. The lab then would assess those samples and mail the unit a response and directed action. So all of that is and can be done, depending on the capabilities you have in your formation, at the unit level now. And so whether it's heat, vibration, dynamic rotating components, age, or frankly, oil, that directed action back is really what I'm talking about. And it's directing the unit commander to say, hey, over the next 25 hours, the probability of an engine failure is X. And so this aircraft is going to go into a phase maintenance program. We recommend you change this component now, even though it has not failed yet. And that then forestalls the eventual unscheduled downtime that aircraft would, or tank, or Bradley, M777, Paladin, whatever we're talking about, that forestalls that unscheduled downtime that would occur.
Let's talk a little bit about some leadership topics. And I want to talk about one that is fairly popular now that a lot of people are talking about, and it's mentoring. What have you seen? What has been your experience with mentoring, mentors that maybe you've had or people that you mentor now, and the positive effects that you've seen from either formal or informal mentoring programs?
David, that, you know, this is such an important topic. And so the Army, over my 3 decades of service, the importance of mentoring has evolved over time. And so we fall in love with it, and we create very formal mentor-mentee relationships with contracts. And that ebbs over time, and everybody falls back into an informal mentoring relationships, some formal. What I can tell you is I have mentors today that are long retired from service that still advise me, or that I reach out to and ask for their advice. I also have mentors that are in my peer group. And frankly, I have mentors that are subordinate to me, not all within my organization. And I have people that reach out to me that are in my peer group, that are subordinate, which is the most common, of course. And in some of these cases, they're long-standing relationships. And what I feel is everybody, regardless of where you sit, regardless of your grade, can benefit from a network of advisors, whether they're sitting next to you in a cubicle, whether they're working below you, or frankly, working above you. Everybody can benefit from a network of advisors, and everybody could benefit from your experience. Because you're a GS-9 or a GS-11 or a GS-15, you are also a mentor. Whether you're formally mentoring somebody or just people are observing you, there are traits in your daily life, in your daily professional life, that people admire. And if, in fact, somebody comes up and asks you, hey, I really like the way you dealt with that situation, whatever that situation might have been, or I really like the way you conveyed information, can you kind of explain to me how you did that and how you learned to do that and how I can perhaps do it better? Be open. That's somebody reaching out because they admire something in you. So be open to that experience. Be transparent and be willing to share. Because you can mentor at your level, you can mentor subordinates, and frankly, you can mentor superiors. If somebody comes to you and asks you for advice on something, be willing to share your experience, because that's what makes the team more powerful. And subsequently, if somebody comes up to you and gives you a little bit of constructive criticism or constructive feedback, be open to receiving it. I still get a lot of constructive feedback. I'm sure that I'll get some on this podcast.
You might, yes.
And at the end of the day, you have to construct your leadership style and your professional life so that you are willing to accept feedback. All that feedback might not be appropriate. It frankly might not even be applicable. So you take what is appropriate and you take what's applicable and apply it. And at the end of the day, do not be afraid of sharing your experiences, because there is somebody sitting in that room that admires the way you are doing your job. And frankly, the more you share it, the more powerful the team becomes. At the end of the day, our responsibility, a mentor told me early in my career, and this is a mentor who is still in my life today, she told me that as a leader, I should be spending 20% of my time building the bench, making the team stronger, making those that are coming up in their careers more aware, more communicative, and help them develop their leader characteristics and their leadership styles. And I have to be honest with you, I don't meet that mark, right? I try to. 20% is a heavy investment, and I think that's about right. So it's a goal that I've set for myself. It's frankly why I'm sitting here doing this podcast. This is about mentoring.
And we appreciate you being here, definitely. Think back a little bit about when you first became an Army civilian. Did you sense that there was mentoring happening then for Army civilians? Did you feel that mentoring was available to you at that time?
So I have to be honest with you, David. When I came in 1989 as an intern, my first few years were really all about learning, right? Learning about the Army, learning about logistics. And when I got out of that role in my early jobs, early on in my career, I was lucky to work with supervisors that demonstrated this trait of sharing and advising and really sometimes assuming what can be an uncomfortable role, and that is providing constructive criticism. And I felt that was not universal in my peer group, regardless of where that peer group happened to work. I found that they were not benefiting from that level of feedback. What I took away from that is, by and large, it was a little bit of luck to end up in an organization that had a leader that understood the importance of it. As I advanced in my career from a team leader to a branch chief to a division chief and then on up, I've tried to model that very first supervisor and provide positive feedback where somebody is exhibiting traits that I find are positive and helps to move the team forward. And then sometimes calling somebody aside to give them a little bit of constructive criticism on perhaps where they could evolve the approach that they're taking. Not always appreciated in the moment, but I have had innumerable people come back to me over the years and said, hey, that was the best advice that I had the opportunity to receive in their respective careers.
when I first became a civilian, I had someone here at in the Fort Leavenworth Public Affairs Office that acted as a mentor towards me. He was a role model, and I watched how he ran our shop and how he interacted with the media and all that, and I thought that's the pattern that I would like to follow. I think that the difference perhaps over the years has been maybe a more full-throated acknowledgement in the Army civilian world that, yeah, we need people to mentor us, and we have things that we can mentor others about, that kind of that acknowledgement that we do need that. Let's talk a little bit about resilience, what the importance of that is, dealing with setbacks, dealing with when things don't go the way that you thought they were going to go. Why is that important?
Yeah, David, that's excellent. And so I always tie resilience to persistence. And what I mean by that is sometimes in government service, certainly on the civilian side, it takes a certain level of persistence to ensure that we institutionalize change needed in whatever process that you happen to work in. If you're an advocate for change, what I found is you will receive a series of no's over time, and you'll receive not necessarily the support that you might feel is obvious and needed. Sometimes you just have to be persistent. You have to be persistent as the understanding of whatever challenge that you happen to be pursuing. The understanding of the importance of that challenge evolves in the leadership and management ranks. Sometimes you have to be persistent as the resourcing picture might evolve over time to resource your particular challenge. And sometimes you just have to be persistent to ensure that whatever barrier you might be experiencing, perhaps it's a particular person that has had that job for a long time, or it's a policy position that has been in place for a long time. And you just have to have the persistence to continue to make the case and be resilient enough to walk out of that office with no after no after no, knowing in your heart and in your professional experience that the position you're advocating for is the correct position. And so you have to have not only the resilience to continue to advocate for it, you have to have the persistence. Because sometimes some of these changes, it takes years to embed that change. And so I'll just give you a quick example of that. And that's this business. We talked a little earlier about data. There was a lot of resistance to investing in the ability to gather and collect data, and then to invest in the ability to assess that data to turn it into actionable knowledge early in my career. And that has evolved over time now to where we are today. The leadership has caught up to the fact, or maybe it's just the fact that these early adopters are now the leaders in place. They've caught up to the fact that you can make an enormous amount of difference in the power projection capability of our Army using data, and in my case, data-informed sustainment. And so we're making the necessary investments. But this has been a decades-long pursuit in my case. And so I'm just enjoying the fruits of that persistence and resilience now.
And sometimes the walls or the no's that are, really just show you where the roadblocks are that you've got to figure out, okay, that department doesn't like it. What can we do to get them on board? So you don't find that out unless you try, unless you make the effort.
Yeah, sometimes I refer to that as antibodies. And you know, unless you get in and approach it, you don't really know where those antibodies are.
Absolutely. And so, Mr. Lohman, I want to start wrapping our discussion up. I want to kind of end with some advice that you might have for any branch of civilian that thinks they want to pursue a career as an SES. What kind of things should they do now, and what kind of things should they be forecasting regarding their career?
Yeah, that, David, thank you. So I often am asked this question, and I will tell you, the desire to serve at a senior executive rank is laudable. I mean, it is an important function of management within and leader capabilities within our Army or with any of the services or within the Department of Defense. You really need to start thinking about mid-career mark. You need to start pursuing opportunities that are outside of your functional comfort zone. Because what we're looking for in the senior executive ranks are leaders that can lead high-performing teams of multiple technical experts, not necessarily to be a technical expert in and of themselves. And so what gets you to a point where you're getting accepted for the Senior Service College, for example, is a civilian, very important that you go to the Senior Service College, not just for the education opportunities, but for the relationships with those future uniform leaders that come out of the senior service college experience. You also need to understand that your technical expertise is what propels you forward in your early career and mid-career portions of your career. What makes you successful as an executive service member, senior executive service member, is your ability to step back from your technical expertise and your understanding that you really have to begin leading the technical experts. And so developing trust in your subordinates that they are the technical experts, allowing them the opportunity to present to senior leadership, to take charge and lead their own analytical capabilities, that's the critical failure point I see when 15s or colonels, for that example, step into senior executive roles, is they have an inability to leave that technical expertise behind them and the ability to lead and trust subordinates to be the technical experts. It takes a level of trust to rely on somebody else instead of yourself. That's, to me, what makes a successful senior leader.
And it's very difficult to pull yourself out, looking at a discrete process and saying, I've done that job, I can do it, and to say, I've got to step away from it and let the person that is doing it do that job. Because if I do their job, then there's something that's not getting done.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And that's where, you know, people who do have a hard time making the transition to senior executive ranks, that's really the predominant failure point, because it's hard to step away. It's fulfilling to be the technical expert, be the person the commander goes to answer all the questions, right? I mean, that's how you've grown up your entire career. And that's the same trait that, while it's made you successful in the past, it's the one trait that is going to hold you back as a senior executive. So take jobs that are uncomfortable, right? Stretch your comfort zone. Make sure that you're developing your leader acumen and your ability to communicate. And then finally, acknowledge that while the reason you're being assessed for a potential senior executive service position is because you are the technical expert, that's not why they're hiring you should you get hired. They're hiring a leader that can lead technical experts.
And so, Mr. Christopher Lohman, I want to thank you so much for giving up your time today during your visit to Fort Leavenworth to talk to our Leader Up audience. Thank you so much for joining us today.
David, thank you for the opportunity to communicate with the Army civilians and to participate in the podcast.
And so, Leader Up audience, what did you hear today from Mr. Lohman? What kind of things did he talk about that kind of piqued your interest? He talked a lot about mentoring. What did he say that kind of appeals to you about mentoring? Do you have a mentor? Is there someone who wants you to be their mentor and you kind of don't know it yet? Keep those things in mind, folks, and subscribe to our podcast and join us again next time for another edition of Leader Up.
As always, if you have any questions or feedback or would like to learn more about our podcast, please check the description for our email and for our website. Thanks for listening.